Good evening and welcome to Chicago Tonight. I'm Brandis Friedman.
And I'm Paris Schutz on the show tonight.
Your judgment is just significantly impaired.
Many CTA bus and train conductors are paid for as much as an 80-hour work week.
The urgency of this is something I live with literally every day.
Gun rights groups are ready to metaphorically fire back on a bill to ban assault weapons.
A new report shows drug and alcohol deaths are on the rise among older Americans. How come and what can be done?
There are tribal communities at risk of being washed away.
More support for tribal communities facing the threats of climate change. That and more in a new WTTW News column.
This means a lot to myself, but I think it really means a lot to just to the sport.
The University of Chicago is celebrating its first NCAA soccer championship, led by the first woman to coach a men's title team. We talked to her on the big win.
No cold man is here.
Let me get an apricot.
Nobody in the hell drinks this apricot.
We sit with one of the co-creators and lead actors of the HBO Max sitcom, Southside.
People during the holidays, more than any other time, really return to the familiar.
And the Newbery Consort partners with two Chicago ensembles to bring in the holidays with 17th century Mexican Christmas music.
But first, some of today's top stories. Some Chicago restaurants are getting a big payout from Uber. City of Chicago reached a $10 million settlement with the online food delivery platform over claims of deceptive practices. The settlement is resolving claims that the company was listing restaurants on their platform without consent and violating the city's emergency fee cap ordinance. The Illinois Restaurant Association said in a statement that their restaurants will receive immediate benefit from the settlement. A representative of Uber said in a statement that they are, quote, committed to supporting Uber Eats restaurant partners in Chicago and are pleased to put this matter behind them.
A former Chicago Transit Authority clerk has been charged with stealing $350,000 from the agency's retirement fund. The U.S. Attorney's Office announced Ayanna Nesbitt was indicted on 5 counts of wire fraud. She allegedly created dozens of false death and pension benefit requests over 2 years, money that was intended for CTA retirees or their beneficiaries. Nesbitt is due in court for an arraignment on Thursday.
No need to rush for that real ID just yet. The U.S. federal government has once again delayed the nationwide security requirements for driver's licenses and other identification, citing the lingering impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic as the reason. Originally, the requirements were expected to start this spring. Now the deadline is to get that updated ID, that is May 2025. Once it goes into effect, U.S. travelers 18 or older taking domestic commercial flights will need the enhanced ID.
And coming up in the program, University of Chicago brings home its first NCAA soccer championship. We'll talk with the groundbreaking coach.
But first, dozens of CTA operators are working 80-hour weeks. WTTW News investigates right after this.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by Alexandra and John Nichols, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
The CTA is under fire with complaints about long waits and so-called ghost buses and trains. Many of those problems are driven by a severe staffing shortage. Last month, the CTA's president said the agency had 600 to 700 open bus driver jobs and 100 to 200 open positions for train operators. As a result, many operators are working overtime, but OT can have big consequences for safety and for the agency's bottom line. WTTW News reporter Nick Blumberg has been investigating this issue and joins us now. Nick, what did you find?
Well, Paris, COVID fallout and the so-called Great Resignation really have taken a big toll on the agency's workforce. But the CTA's use of overtime isn't new. In response to a records request, WTTW News obtained bus and train operator work records from 2015 to 2021. They show how many hours every one of those thousands of employees was paid for each year, and we focused our analysis on the employees putting in the most time. In 2015, less than 5% of the agency's operator workforce was paid for an average of 50 or more hours a week. By 2021, that number jumped to nearly 14%. 33 of those operators were paid for average weeks of 80 hours or more, double the standard 40-hour week. Three of those operators were paid for an average week of more than 100 hours.
All right, so there's a distinction here in terms of work hours paid versus hours worked. Why that distinction?
Well, the records the agency sent us show how many hours each employee was paid for. Now, that includes paid time off and authorized breaks. The CTA declined to do an on-camera interview, but in written comments said it has a strong safety record in line with transit agencies around the U.S., and said the number of major safety events have declined steadily since 2019. They also outlined the work rules in place aimed at keeping employees and passengers safe, which we'll tell you about. But sleep experts say even with safeguards in place, long hours can have damaging effects.
In 2014, a Blue Line operator pulling into O'Hare fell asleep at the controls, slamming into a post and landing on an escalator. 33 passengers were hurt.
Boom. I was thrown from my seat to the other seat, and that's where I twisted my ankle here. And that's when I just seen a lot of people screaming and everything.
Leading up to the crash, that operator had worked 12 consecutive days and had regularly requested overtime. Dr. Kenneth Lee is medical director for UChicago Medicine's Sleep Center. He says long hours and not enough time off are likely to cause some degree of sleep deprivation.
Even if you're getting some sleep at night, but if this continues on for several days or several weeks, you know, your judgment is just significantly impaired.
After the Blue Line crash, the National Transportation Safety Board called on the CTA to make big changes to its policies on how long and how often operators can work. At the time, the agency only required employees to have 8 hours off between shifts. The NTSB's report says, quote, CTA's practice does not give the employees the opportunity to receive enough uninterrupted sleep to be fully alert and operate safely.
Especially in overnight shifts, and you look historically with things such as, you know, Chernobyl or Three Mile Island, all of those happened, you know, kind of, you know, overnight shifts and so forth and everything like that. Now, there's a lot of circumstances as to that, but again, the bottom line from sleep medicine being that, you know, it's really important to make sure that you're getting optimal sleep in order to maintain kind of your peak performance.
Since the crash, the CTA tried to extend the mandatory break to 10 hours. But in a statement, the agency said, quote, a court ruling forced the CTA to pursue this desired change via union negotiations, which it did at the earliest opportunity. The unions representing CTA's bus and rail operators did not agree to the change. One union didn't respond to a request for comment. The other wouldn't discuss overtime.
Short term, if they're working a double shift here and there, might throw the patient off a little bit, but if they're doing it for a long period of time, they could cause a burnout.
Dr. Victor Munoz of Loyola Medicine says many of his patients across different industries have been working longer hours and taking on more shifts. That can contribute to high blood pressure and blood sugar and hurt someone's mental health.
It's a gradual onset, so it'll be stressful at first, possibly go to anxiety, and then to depression. And also family time, relationships, that's another focus, part of the mental aspect.
The CTA told WTTW News that in addition to a minimum of 8 hours between shifts, operators cannot work longer than 5.5 hours without taking a 30 to 60 minute break. Per its union contract, operators cannot work longer than 13 hours per shift unless management asks them to in emergency situations and the operator doesn't show signs of fatigue.
Everybody has different attention spans and that could definitely affect it, especially if they're in charge of machinery, drivers, that kind of thing.
In the years since the O'Hare crash, records show the agency's workforce has dwindled from a combined peak of 5,124 bus and rail operators in 2019 to a low of 4,580 last year. The number of operators being paid for significantly longer than 40 hours a week has risen steadily. Among the 48 employees paid out for average work weeks of 80 hours or more than two-thirds of them logged at least one crash or safety violation between 2015 and 2021. Four of them involved a serious accident or injury.
It's not to say that all drivers that are on overtime are going to have accidents, but if you're driving 80 hours a week, you may be more likely to have an accident than you if you're driving 40 hours a week.
The CTA said in a statement that, quote, safety violations comprise a wide range of potential issues given the agency's extensive list of safety rules and procedures. For example, an employee can be issued a safety violation for failing to report defective equipment or failing to wear or use proper personal protective equipment.
One weekday morning in June 2019, a cyclist was going south here on Wells, approaching Hubbard. He was struck and run over by a CTA bus and rushed to the hospital. The bus driver who struck the cyclist was on overtime.
He'd twice ranked among the drivers paid for the most hours in a year. Hitting the cyclist was his second on-the-job crash. He was fired after an investigation. The CTA later settled a lawsuit the cyclist filed for $1.75 million.
In March 2019, a pedestrian crossing Washington at this intersection was struck by a CTA bus. She also sued the CTA, accusing the driver of negligence. The agency settled that suit for an undisclosed amount.
The driver who struck that pedestrian has regularly been among the operators paid out for the most hours. After the crash, he admitted being distracted and took full responsibility. Records show he told his manager that going forward, he'd work less overtime. But he didn't, or couldn't. In 2019, the year of that crash, that driver was paid for an average of 66 hours a week. In 2020, he was paid for an average of 85 hours a week, and then an average of 89 hours a week last year.
Anecdotally, we hear lots of stories from operators about how burnt out they get by having to do so much overtime. Operators really want to have downtime like anybody else, and when they finish their job, they would like to go home and see their family and friends.
It's not just a question of safety. It's not just the cost of paying out settlements after crashes. Overtime for CTA bus and train operators means big bucks. Their hourly pay during this time period topped out at $36, and OT pays out at time and a half. Last year, the agency's highest paid operator earned more than $200,000, nearly three times the base salary.
Overtime is built into the operations of transit. There's absenteeism, you know, there's time off for vacations and so forth. It makes sense to fill that through overtime rather than hiring new people. The challenge is now, of course, is that this is on top of a very difficult time of having lost riders, having lost revenue. And so the cost associated with having to incur more overtime, I think, takes on added significance.
The CTA's gone over budget on bus and train operator overtime every year since 2015. Most of that OT comes from bus drivers, rising from $7.7 million in overtime costs in 2015 to $13.1 million last year.
Not only does that make us pay more for less employees, but it also means, in terms of its pension plan, if employees have a lot of overtime, that can also be counted towards their final years of pay. And so then the CTA's pension plan is paying out that money over the long term.
Counting overtime towards public employee pensions is unique in Illinois to CTA employees. At the beginning of the year, the CTA's pension plan was 55% funded.
In general, 80% is considered a reasonable number to be funded.
By law, the plan has to get to 60% in 10 years and 90% by 2059. Its administrator told WTTW News it's on track to exceed those requirements. Quote, not all employees are earning high overtime, and the retirement plan uses the average of an employee's four highest years when calculating benefits, which blunts the impact of a single high year. Both employees and the agency contribute to the plan. This year, the CTA was projected to make $136 million in contributions.
It's not to say the employees don't deserve overtime, but it is something that is a long-term cost for the CTA. A lot of overtime now might solve the short-term crisis of, you know, we need operators, and certainly we do, but it could create a longer-term budget implication.
In a statement, the CTA said, quote, even as the CTA takes steps to overcome industry-wide hiring and retention challenges, providing safe operations and safe service are and have been CTA's top priority. CTA workplace rules, which are in keeping with labor contracts and industry best practices, are in place to ensure that CTA rail and bus operators can safely and responsibly carry out their duties while still allowing them to pursue opportunities for extra income. Now, the agency also said employees are required to complete training on fatigue and sleep apnea, and the CTA noted that there aren't any federal or state rules regarding hours on the job that apply here, though Paris, the agency said it's been advocating for those rules to increase its ability to prevent any sort of fatigue or potential safety issues.
And just to reiterate, Nick, these long hours we're talking about are per individual work week.
That's right. Last year, nearly 14% of bus and train operators were paid for average weeks of 50 hours or more, with dozens for double the standard 40 hours a week or more. Though, as we noted, that also includes paid time off and authorized breaks, so it isn't all hours worked. Still, some very long shifts that certain employees are putting in part that's driven by a staffing shortage. And tomorrow we'll tell you about what the CTA is doing to close that gap, as well as the challenges that it and other agencies around the U.S. are facing right now.
Long festering challenge for the CTA. All right, Nick, good work.
Thank you.
And now, Brad, as we toss it back to you.
Paris, thank you. Illinois' lawmakers are on break now, but there is already major legislation to deal with when they return to Springfield in early January, a proposal that would ban so-called assault weapons. It's spurred in part by the mass shooting this summer in Highland Park. And Amanda Venicky joins us now with more. Amanda, what would this bill do?
Brandis, this controversial gun measure before legislators is wide-ranging. It would do several things. First, it would establish a statewide strike team to combat guns illegally trafficked across state lines. It seeks to expand the state's red flag law by extending how long police could keep a gun from someone who's been deemed dangerous by a court. It also increases to 21 years old the age someone can have a firearm owner's identification or FOID card, and that's something that allows them to own and to buy guns. And then also, and this is the main thrust of the proposal, it prevents the future sale of what the measure describes as assault-grade weapons and large-capacity magazines.
At the state level, we can regulate these 20, 30, even 40-bullet magazines. Really just on its face is something that the state of Illinois is invested in and should have a role in relative to public safety. We're seeing these extended clips used not just in the Highland Park shooting where the shooter had multiple 30 bullet magazines, but across the state where there are mass shootings, you're seeing these high capacity magazine clips being used.
State Representative Bob Morgan was marching in the July 4th parade where a 21-year-old Highland Park resident allegedly used an AR-15-style semi-automatic rifle to open fire, killing seven people. Morgan says he had been impacted by gun violence previously and was interested in the pursuit of what he calls common sense legislation. But he says the Highland Park shooting is among the incidents that has brought renewed urgency to taking action.
I don't want to wait. Because every day that we wait is just another mass shooting. And that is an incredibly real and poignant reminder of the urgency behind this work.
The Illinois State Rifle Association's lobbyist says what Morgan is trying to do is an overreach, especially, he says, in light of the U.S. Supreme Court's Bruin decision, which was issued in June. Gun rights groups are already preparing lawsuits in case this measure passes.
These are commonly used firearms. Think about the mag ban, the large capacity magazine ban that is part of this bill. Most of the handguns, semi-automatic handguns you buy today, come with magazine capacities greater than 10. And so what you're telling people is you're going to take away our property.
I also today spoke with Dan Eldridge, who owns a gun shop and shooting range in Des Plaines. He's also president of the State Firearm Dealers Association. And he says what Morgan is trying to do is a clear civil rights violation. He says it would make criminals out of law-abiding Illinois residents. I asked him about an argument often made by those seeking to limit ammunition, who say there's no reason for someone to need high-capacity magazines.
So it's not a question of what do you need, it's a question of what do you want? What do you choose to use as a law-abiding person to defend yourself in a justified manner, justified use of deadly force, sport, targets, whatever. It's irrelevant how many rounds are in the magazine.
Sullivan says what happened in Highland Park is horrifying. Still, he says,
they don't understand, those of us that have grown up in a culture where firearms and hunting are part of our identity. And so I don't know how to bridge that gap.
Now, Amanda, we've heard from both sides. What is the likelihood that, you know, that this could become law? What's the timeline?
Well, Brandis, the legislature is back for what's called its lame duck session in early January. That is the brief window when legislators who are either retiring or they lost their seats, that's when they're going to stay in the General Assembly just before new lawmakers take their place. Morgan says he is hoping to move this proposal then. Democrats hold supermajorities now. They will also during that new session. And this is a priority for the governor. Morgan says with that, he is hoping for bipartisan support.
There's no doubt that for many years, the idea of passing these common sense reforms was just antithetical to the political will. We just didn't have the political courage to do it. That's changed.
A series of hearings will be held on this measure in December. The first of those is scheduled for the 12th. Gun rights advocates say they know that this is an uphill battle, but even if it does pass, they say that they have the federal law on their side. And again, they are ready with legal action.
Amanda, you mentioned the age change for a FOID card. The Highland Park shooter was 21, though, right?
He was 21 on July 4th, but he had gotten his FOID card previously. And how Illinois does this is when you're 18, 19, or 20, you need to have a sponsor, a parent or guardian who signs off on your getting a FOID card. And so what gun rights groups, for example, the ISRA Sullivan, say is that this suspect never should have had a gun in the first place because he'd already had some encounters with the police. A clear and present danger report had been filed. He says if the state police had done their jobs, held onto that report and filed it, he would not have been able to get a FOID card. But Representative Morgan says that it is too young. I asked him, you know, you can serve in the military when you're 18, right? And of course, those are individuals who use guns. There is an exception and a carve out for those who serve in the military. But this would do away with having that parental sponsorship when you're 18 through 20 years old. People would still be able to use a gun, say, to go hunting, as a lot of folks do with their parents or families, but that's when they are there. So this older age limit would mean that nobody in that age bracket would be able to buy a gun.
Of course, more to come on this as the hearings, like you said, they start next week. Amanda Vinicky, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Up next, meet the groundbreaking soccer coach who just led the University of Chicago's men's soccer team to an NCAA championship. Stay with us. Do you think there's been sort of a rethinking of how those events happened here in Chicago?
I made a promise to myself in my career that every year I would make a piece of art dedicated to the memory.
Got into a zone of mentor to children. See what we could do to kind of elevate each other. We all we got at this point.
I'm using my past to push forward, to build a movement, to create the world that we all want to see.
For the first time in history, the University of Chicago men's soccer team has brought home the NCAA Division III soccer title. And that's notable for a school that's better known for bringing home Nobel Prizes. The team's coach also made history as the first woman to coach a men's soccer team to an NCAA title. And here to talk about all that and more is Illinois native and the University of Chicago men's soccer coach Julianne Sitch, and she brought something with her.
Yes.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
How does it feel?
Feels great.
So, you know, this was your first year coaching the men's soccer team at the University of Chicago. Did you go in feeling kind of confident that this was the team that could go all the way?
I knew in the past they've been there, you know, for the past couple years, and knowing the former coach and what the foundation that the previous staff has laid and the team has laid, you know, they've been there before. They were eager, they were hungry, they wanted to be back into this position and have another opportunity to go for the title.
You're the first woman to coach a men's soccer team to an NCAA title. Tell me a little bit about the significance of what you've done.
Yeah, I wouldn't be here without, you know, obviously everyone that has come before me, and especially the former coach for throwing my name forward, and, you know, for the athletic director, Angie Turain, to, you know, take a chance to hire a female to coach a men's team. So I think this is just a significant moment where, you know, for my whole life, dreaming to try to be a professional soccer player, the people I looked up to were men. You know, when I was young and I played on an all-boys team when I was 5 through 7 or 8 and, you know, had a lot of male coaches in my life that I'm very appreciative for. And just being able to, not really until 1999 when the iconic 99ers that we like to call them won the World Cup is really when I could dream and believe to be a professional soccer player that I always have always dreamed of. So I think this moment is just great for women across the board and for young boys to just, you know, you can see it, you can believe it, you can dream it, and it's something that you can aspire to be.
As you mentioned, you've been breaking glass ceilings since you were five. When you were the only girl on the Oswego, Illinois soccer team, you broke the ceiling for NCAA men's soccer. Was this a first for your players as well to have had a woman as a coach?
Yes, you know, for the first time, I believe for all of them, this is the first time that they had a female coach. And, you know, they embraced me on day one, and for that, I'm forever grateful.
Any pushback, skeptics, when you first took that job?
No, absolutely not. Definitely not from the university, not from the players, you know, and also, you know, the assistant coach as well. First time working with a female, and, you know, I had nothing but absolute just like confidence from all of them, belief in all of them. So it's been a very incredible journey.
Now, as you said, you know, you played and coached at the professional level with Chicago Red Stars. What attracted you to, obviously you'd been at the University of Chicago before, but what attracted you back to this team? Because the university is more known for its Nobel Prizes in economics and physics than athletics.
Yeah, I absolutely loved my time when I was there on the women's side. And, you know, you're working with just gritty, resilient student athletes. You know, they have worked hard their whole entire life. They want to be at their best, both on and off the field. And that was something that I truly just loved during my time. You know, these student athletes inspired me. They really, for the amount of work that they do and, you know, being at a rigorous university like University of Chicago, but they step on the field and they give their everything to their teammates. They give everything to the staff, to the athletic department. And that was something that I just truly was inspired by when I was working there. And I wanted to be back to be a part of that.
There is a woman managing a Yankees minor league baseball team, two women running the Miami Marlins as president and general manager. What do you think it would take to see more women in sports leadership positions?
Yeah, you know, I think it takes someone to hire these women and to provide these opportunities for women. And, you know, again, that's why for myself, I'm very fortunate that Angie did take a risk, you know, to hire me. And I think that is that's the next step, right? People in these leadership roles creating these opportunities or the opportunities that are there for women or really for anyone who is qualified and can step into these roles. You know, I think that's what it's going to take, people to step out and to do it.
Of course, I have to ask. So when your players are running towards you, you've won the game, you actually stopped to get the dousing of the blue Gatorade or Powerade. You're a former professional soccer player. You knew it was coming. You could have run.
I could have run, yes.
And pretty fast at that. You could have run away from it, but you took it anyway.
I did, yes.
Why?
You know, just like what a moment, you know, and for them that they went and grabbed the cooler, and I just was running out, and when I saw them out of the corner of my eye, when I looked back, I was like, you know, I'm going to take this, and, you know, just it was great.
Fine, hit me.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about next season. Are you feeling good about a repeat? Because I think you're losing about six seniors.
Yes, we'll lose six seniors and two great six seniors and two incredible leaders that I've been blessed to step into this program and help lead this team to this national chip title. You know, we're obviously going to continue to push. You know, I think, again, this program has been there in the couple years in the past, and we hope to continue to keep the team there.
Your old team, Chicago Red Stars, being put up for sale, we have to ask while we've got you here, after a scathing report about the allegations of abusive behavior and sexual misconduct in women's professional soccer. What's your reaction to the sale in wake of that report?
Yeah, that's a tough question. You know, it's unfortunate I spent a vast majority of my professional career with Chicago Red Stars, you know, and they gave me a lot of opportunities to be here. So, you know, it's a difficult time.
Any possibility that the Red Stars might not stay in Chicago?
I don't think so. I think they'll stay in Chicago.
What's your advice for other women who want to do what you do?
Yeah, I think just for women and young men and young boys in general, I think one of the greatest things that my parents ever instilled in me was just to dream big. Dream big, go after it, always work hard, believe in yourself. You know, I think that's one of the biggest ones. There's a lot of times where not everyone's going to believe in you. Not everyone's going to think you can go out there and do that. And so having that self-belief within yourself, and don't be afraid to dream it and go after it.
Okay, before we let you go, how heavy is this?
It's a little heavy.
It's a little heavy. You don't mind it at all.
No, that's right.
Julianne Sitch, congrats again. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Brandis, for having me. I appreciate it.
And now, Paris, we toss it back to you.
Thanks, Brandis. Huge congratulations to the coach and to the Maroons. And still to come on Chicago Tonight, more support for tribal communities facing the threats of climate change. That and more as we debut a new WTTW News column. New data shows drug and alcohol overdoses are on the rise among older Americans. We examine why and what can be done. We chat with Sutan Salahuddin, co-creator and star of HBO's South Side, with a new season set to debut this week.
People during the holidays, more than any other time, really return to the familiar.
And the Newbery Consort partners with two Chicago ensembles to bring in the holidays with 17th century Mexican Christmas music. But first, some more of today's top stories. Petition challenges for the 2023 municipal election are in. That's where some candidates seek to remove other candidates from the ballot for insufficient petition signatures. Some of the mayoral candidates being challenged are community activist Jamal Green and Alderman Roderick Sawyer. They're both being challenged by former State Senator Ricky Hendon, who is a top advisor to mayoral candidate Willie Wilson. In turn, Wilson is being challenged by a reported ally of Jamal Green. Let the games begin. The University of Illinois Chicago Faculty Union says it is set to strike on January 17th. The UIC United Faculty says in a statement that they, quote, worked one semester without a contract and they won't work another. The union says job security and expanded mental health care for students are some of the issues at stake. In a recent statement, university leadership said it is, quote, confident that much can be accomplished through continued bargaining. No need to rush for that real ID just yet. The federal government has once again delayed the nationwide security requirements for driver's license and other identification, citing the lingering impacts of COVID-19 as the reason. Originally, the requirements were expected to start this spring. Now, the deadline to get that updated ID is May 2025. And once it goes into effect, U.S. travelers 18 or older taking domestic commercial flights will need that enhanced ID. And wave goodbye to Sue the T-Rex, or at least her right arm. The dinosaur's arm was temporarily removed from the field by the Field Museum today so it could be CAT scanned and photographed for further study. It's part of the museum's Dino December. They're also offering storytelling events and virtual tours for classrooms. Some tribal communities vulnerable to the effects of climate change are getting some support. And new research gives us a look into what makes great gray owls so great. Those are just some of the stories featured on our new WTTW News column called This Week in Nature. And it's written by our very own, you guessed it, WTTW News reporter Patty Wetley, who joins us now with more. Hey, Patty. All right. This Week in Nature, brand new column. What do you hope people get out of this? And this is going to be every week, right?
Yeah, it's going to be weekly every Friday.
This Week in Nature.
Yes, exactly. Self-explanatory, sort of. Well, a lot of it has to do with all of the really fascinating content that I come across in the course of a week that doesn't really fit into the parameter of something that I might report on or write an article for WTTW, but I thought this stuff is really too good to not share with our audience. So this is a way to just get more interesting, sometimes even funny, information about the environment, climate change, wildlife, nature, really, to our audience, and just things that I've come across in the week that have sort of caught my attention.
All right, your first column appeared Friday, so let's get into one of the stories you highlighted in this column. Some tribal communities in the U.S. are facing immediate threats of climate change, and they're going to get some assistance, Patty. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so the federal government is giving each of three tribes $25 million each. There's two tribal communities in Alaska and one in the state of Washington. And that money will go toward assisting them with relocation. These are coastal communities that are actually losing their land to rising sea level, erosion, and this will partly give them the money that they need to move to higher ground or further inland. There's another eight communities that are receiving $5 million each to further study and create a relocation plan. This being thought of as sort of a way for the government to take a look at sort of a trial of how these kinds of relocations might work. And even though this money is going toward tribal communities, it's not hard to think that there's plenty of communities in the coastal U.S. that might need to think about relocation in the future.
Absolutely. Could affect millions of people. All right. This one's a little more fun story. Gray owls. There's some new research about them. What are we learning about them?
We're learning what fantastic predators they are. There's some research coming out of the University of California, Riverside, that studied how far underneath snow these owls can actually sense their prey, specifically in the form of voles. And they have these very wide, flat faces that work kind of like radar, and their wings have these sound dampening qualities so that it blocks out all other noise, and they can actually sense these voles 2 feet under snow. And even though the snow kind of distorts sounds that the voles are making, the owls will like hover right above to zone in, so that radar zones in exactly, and they can swoop in on prey that is 2 feet below snow. Wow, so I think that's pretty amazing.
And that's a very evil look in those owls' eyes. All right, Patty, we will
look
online.
Cool.
I didn't say they were uncool, just kind of evil looking. All right, Patty, thanks very much. We'll read this online. And you can read Patty's column on our website, where you can expect to see weekly updates every Friday. It's all at WTTW.com/news. And now to Brandis with a look at some new alarming data from the CDC. Brandis.
In Paris, more than 1 million people have died from COVID-19 in the U.S., but we are still finding out how the pandemic may have impacted countless other lives, contributing to many additional deaths. A new CDC report shows drug and alcohol-related deaths among older Americans surged in 2020, with a 53% increase in deaths from opioids over the previous year. And alcohol-induced deaths among seniors rose 18% from 2019 to 2020. CDC data also shows that men over 75 are 4 times more likely to die from alcohol than women the same age. The highest rates of drug overdose deaths were among black men and women, and there was a 31% increase in drug overdose deaths for black men ages 65 to 74 years old. Here to take a look at this disturbing data and what it means for seniors are Lorianne Post, Bueller Professor for Aging and Director of the Bueller Center for Health Policy and Economics at the Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine, and Craig Lamb, Clinical Director at Gateway Foundation, a network of addiction treatment centers. Thanks to you both for joining us. Lori Post, let's start with you, please. What are your thoughts on what might be driving this, what seems to be a dramatic increase in overdose deaths among older adults?
Well, I think that the pandemic, of course, is affecting everybody and people are left more alone. But older adults are way more likely to suffer from social isolation, depression, more likely to have multiple prescriptions that might interact that they're unaware of. And then the other thing is that they're still using. It's mirroring the pattern of increase in younger adults. The same thing is happening with older adults. And so we shouldn't think just because they're old that they're not out there using recreational drugs and alcohol.
Craig Lamb, same question to you. Your thoughts on what's behind this increased overdose rate?
Yes, certainly I agree with Lori that the COVID pandemic did create more isolation for people. Older adults, also some of them suffering from chronic pain, may be using opiates as prescribed, but there may become problems, which leads to greater risk. Also, there's increase in fentanyl use, maybe even not intentionally. People may be taking their opiate medication, and it may be laced with fentanyl.
Could retirement sometimes trigger increased use in drugs or alcohol? For example, if you know that you don't have to report to work the next day, maybe you're not as careful with drugs and alcohol the night before.
Certainly any life change is going to exacerbate the risk. You've got a new leisure or maybe more free time, like you said, less structure, less accountability, or more stress.
Lori Post, tell us a little bit about how, as we age, our bodies metabolize drugs and alcohol differently.
So the older we get, then the less likely our bodies can metabolize alcohol and drugs. So you could be using the same dose that you have a whole lifetime, and then when you get older, your body can no longer take that. It just wears out, and you can overdose easier.
So a glass of wine, for example, it's more than just a glass of wine.
Yeah, I mean, there's good guidelines for how much alcohol people should use. And so as we age, that number drops down quite a bit.
Are seniors at increased risk of falling or incurring deadly injury when they use drugs and alcohol?
Yeah, absolutely. Older adults are more likely to have falls than younger adults are. And when people fall, they break their hips, break other things, and that can lead to death.
Craig, you know, of course, while we're seeing this increase, data still shows that alcohol and drug deaths are far less common still in seniors than other age groups. But our rehab facilities, are they often more tailored towards younger populations, younger patients?
There are programs that are tailored to younger patients, but at Gateway Foundation, we treat all adults 18 and up, and certainly we have older adults in our programs. And that includes residential or outpatient, even virtual services at this point. Because like we talked about the isolation, some people, especially older adults, may not be able to make it into treatment. They may be at home, and we'd still want to make sure they get the treatment they need to address the substance use issue.
To that end, is the approach to recovery for the older age group, could it be any different than for younger?
There might be some differences, but I think generally we're using evidence-based practices. We're going to go where the data is and use what's effective.
During the pandemic, did you notice more people who had been in recovery relapsing because of their reduced access to services?
Certainly. At the beginning of the pandemic, a lot of the support systems were shut off or closed down. Eventually, they did come back online, and a lot of services came back virtually, which did help, but there was an increase.
Laura, you mentioned this earlier, just about how much of this is due to the pandemic. You know, we already have data showing that alcohol-related deaths overall were up 25% in 2020 compared with 2019. So do you think this new data about older Americans specifically, is it mirroring what we've seen in the younger population?
It's definitely mirroring. There was, I think it's a little bit hidden here, though. There was an escalation of cases of opioid use and opioid overdose death. That began about mid-2018 and escalated before the pandemic hit, and then the pandemic only made it worse.
Okay. Craig, do you think things have, you know, returned to normal at all for people who are in recovery, or, you know, what of a certain percentage of people who may not have been able to resume recovery, you know, after the pandemic?
Yeah, I think a lot of the support systems have come back online, and I would want people to know that there's help out there. Especially when we're talking about opiate use, there's medications available now, I think. Seeking evidence-based treatment with medication-assisted treatment is now the standard for treating this disorder.
Holidays are a time when people might feel isolated or depressed. What are some of your suggestions for anybody who may increasingly think about turning to substances to battle some of their stressors?
I would encourage people to reach out and get help. I think about the way we look at physical health. You go to a gym, you talk about a diet, especially holidays, beginning of the year, people start making commitments. I think people should look at mental health and substance use the same way. Like, if I have a question, I should go get checked out. I should go ask somebody. Go see my doctor.
In the last year or two, you know, a lot of experts and organizations have been sounding an alarm about mental health and the looming crisis. You know, when you look at how some people use substances, alcohol or drugs, to manage their mental health challenges, you know, do you have concerns about the use and the growing use of substance abuse in this country?
I definitely have concerns, too. And also we're seeing in this recent wave of escalation, which includes fentanyl, also with stimulants. And we're seeing this with older adults as well, too, including methamphetamines and cocaine use, too. Cut with fentanyl, yeah.
Some disturbing information and disturbing data. Lorianne Post, Craig Lamb, thanks to you both for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And there's more Chicago Tonight just ahead, but first, a look at the weather.
It's a comedy show for Southsiders, made by Southsiders, and it's called, interestingly enough, Southside. Our next guest co-created the program, which follows the travails and the hustles of Simon James and his cohorts at the Rent-to-Own Furniture Shop, a store on the, you guessed it, Southside. The show airs on HBO Max and will soon debut its third season. And co-creator and star of Southside, Sutan Salahuddin, joins us now. Sutan, welcome to Chicago Tonight.
Hey, thanks for having me, Paris. Glad to be here.
And I know you were in town hosting the Midwest Emmys on Saturday,
yes.
So it's been a whirlwind weekend. So this show,
awesome.
it deals with some serious issues, but you've got hilarious characters and situations. How do you go about mining comedy from life on the Southside?
Well, I think it starts with in the writing room, because a lot of the writers are from the Southside, and one of the things that we do in the room is like, let's talk about one of the funniest moments you've ever had. And then it starts there, and then from there we just riff and keep going and build and build, and that's where a lot of the material comes from, real life experiences.
And for the viewers that haven't watched it yet, mm-hmm. just give us the premise.
Well, the premise is basically myself playing Simon James and then my friend Kareem, who plays Kay Odom. We're two regular blue-collar guys who are trying to make our way while still working at a rent-a-center store, but we keep trying all these other things that try to lift our spirits and make us rich. But as you know, that usually doesn't end up well.
And so you're from Chicago, originally from Auburn Gresham,
yes.
South Shore. A lot of the cast is from Chicago, the mm-hmm. writers. What's it like to come here? And you're filming on location, like,
yeah.
everywhere. You were in a Giordano's.
Yes.
You're in Chatham. You're in South Shore. What's that like?
What can I say? I love Chicago. Like, it's a wonderful thing to be able to display the city to people through our show, but it's also another thing when the people from the city and you show up and you're doing your show and they're like, what's going on? Is this another drama? Is this a comedy? What is it? And then they find out that it's Southside and they just get excited, eyes get big. And as everybody in Chicago always knows, they say, hey, you know what this show needs? It needs me. So that's the experience. It's really fun.
You drop so many local references. You mm-hmm. even drop like newscaster names in yeah. one of the episodes I was watching. What was your life like growing up in South Shore and Auburn Gresham? Do you have like some experiences that you've taken over to your writing and to this character?
Yes, a lot of experiences through high school, just playing in the neighborhood, basketball. I mean, in season two, we started off playing softball. Well, we started playing baseball, actually. Mm-hmm. And I grew up playing baseball on the South Side all the time as a kid. You know, I played for, what's the name of that organization?
The one that won the World Series.
Yeah, what's the name?
Jackie Robinson.
Thank you very much.
Jackie
I couldn't remember that for the life of me, but played for Jackie Robinson West. And that was one of the things that we used in the show. So, it's again, it goes back to organic stories that come from all of our experiences that we just fill up. And it's not just me. It's all of the other writers and their experiences as well growing up in Chicago.
And there's just so many negative stereotypes about mm-hmm. Chicago and
yeah.
particularly the South and West Sides and media and TV shows.
It's unfortunate.
What are you trying to get across with this show that's different from those shows?
I think what we want to get across is the fact that, you know, not all of Chicago is bad and not everybody there is going to die and you don't have to run for your life every 5 seconds. I think what we really want to show people is, hey, this is a place where people come together to love, they come together and laugh, and they live and grow here. And these are some of the ways in which they do that. Yes, it can be challenging at times, but I think that's anywhere in America. Our goal is to allow the viewer to come in and let their hair down, kick their feet up, take their jacket off, relax, and spend some wonderful time with us laughing versus, you know, all of the other things that
right. It's fun to spend time. There we see two police officer characters that are hilarious.
Yes.
It's fun to spend time.
Good night, Turner.
With these characters. Yeah, so how much of this reminds me of the style of Curb Your Enthusiasm a little bit. How much of
Thank
this
you.
Is, it's every
Thank
bit
you.
Is funny. How much of this is improvised versus scripted out?
You know, that is a really good question. And because we're blessed with so many talented actors on our show and funny people, that it's 98% scripted and 2% improv. So
okay.
Everybody has to hit their lines. That's how you make sure that the story stays on track and you have a good story, a compelling story. But mm-hmm. a lot of our actors are just naturally funny and very talented. And, you know, sometimes they'll go off the rails. They'll hit all their lines, but then they'll drop something in the front, some juicy in the middle, and something at the end. And we got magic. So, yeah, quite a bit of it is.
In the first season, some of the funny situations arise from the fact that you work at this rent-to-own furniture
yes.
shop.
A
lot of folks don't pay what they owe, so you have to go in and
yes.
get the furniture back.
Unfortunately, I mean, that is a business model that's been set up predominantly in neighborhoods that aren't as affluent, but yeah.
But you get some comedy out of that.
Oh, I mean, you get a lot of comedy out of it. That's how the show actually started. My friend Quincy, who plays Q on the show, he actually worked at Rent-A-Center for like 16 years,
mm-hmm.
and the origin story is basically we were behind my mom's house talking. He was telling me about all the adventures that he was having at his job, and I said, dude, this is a show. We got to take this to Shira Diallo. We got to do something. This is a show.
And now you got season 3 coming up on HBO Woo! Max. You were on Comedy Central.
Yes.
Now you're on HBO Max.
Yes.
Any difference working for the two different networks?
Huge difference. I think the major difference is exposure. I think HBO Max just has a much bigger audience and more people are streaming versus Comedy Central, which is still kind of like cable and an older system. But, you know, once we made the jump from Comedy Central to HBO Max, I mean, I immediately felt the impact because I started getting people in Instagram and people were hitting me like, I didn't even know this show existed. Where you guys been? Because, you know, when we premiered on HBO Max, we premiered with season 2.
Right.
So it was like season 1 was having a new premiering again because people hadn't even known that we were existed. So they got a 2-for-1 when we went to HBO Max. It really helped propel the show.
And when is the premiere date for season 2?
December 8th. Coming
December 8th.
Up. Yeah, this week.
3 days from
now.
Yeah,
man. Very excited.
We're getting ready for it. And you were here in town this week, and we mentioned hosting the Midwest Emmys, the Chicago Emmys.
64th.
I was working backstage, so I didn't get to see a lot of your monologue, but it was pretty funny in the beginning.
Thank you very much.
You had a couple zingers there. What was that experience like?
It was pretty good. I mean, it was hard to tell because one thing you want to do is make sure that you deliver for the Academy and make sure you do your job well. But for the most part, I mean, as long as they approved it, I have no problem delivering it, and we had a good time. You probably couldn't hear this, but I had some really, really good reactions from the audience, and so that felt really, really good. And I had a good time, man. I had a blast.
I heard that, and your first joke was getting everyone to pronounce your name correctly.
Well, it's been a challenge my whole life. I figured it'd be a good place to start laughing at me. Why not?
Yeah. No, it was a fun night. Yeah. It was good to meet you on Saturday, and good to have you here. Sultan Salahuddin, best of luck. Congratulations. Season 3.
Thank you, Paris.
About to get underway.
Indeed.
All right. And now, Brandis, we toss it back to you.
Looking forward to catching that. Thank you, Paris. The Newbery Concert is celebrating the holiday season with an annual concert exploring 17th century Mexican Christmas music. Arts correspondent Angel Edo introduces us to the featured choirs set to take listeners back in time.
Comprised of sounds by two different ensembles, a Mexican Christmas concert hopes to transport listeners back to 17th century Mexico City.
And I thought, well, why not have a convent choir that we might have heard in Mexico City in the 17th century? You'd only hear it kind of over the convent walls, but you could hear it in the streets outside, and people would gather to hear these angelic voices making this beautiful music. But there would also be street bands full of instruments and singers and dancers doing very lively sort of folky music in the streets. And we wanted to put those two things together, and we thought, why not? Let's just do them in alternation, just like you would have heard if you were standing in that plaza.
Christmas is big in Latin America, and what we are doing is a very interesting combination of contrasting pieces of music that are composed for the same season, right? So from the convent ensemble, you will hear some celestial sounds, what you would associate with liturgical, you know, calm. And then the Villancico ensemble provides a really nice contrast with festive music, upbeat. We have voices, instruments, but everything is religious.
With alternating songs in both English and Spanish, the concert features musical numbers derived from Mexican choir books currently housed at the Newbery Library. With sounds of both Old and New Spain, Francie Acosta and her husband José Luis Posada say they hope to restore new interest in old traditions.
It's just the large presence of different things at one moment so long ago. Just to give you an example, some of the songs are called negrillas. We basically refer to African people that were living in Mexico at that time. And they mix like Spanish with some dialects that came at that time also with African people. Nobody thinks that Mexican Christmas music can actually is going to have in some sort of dialect. So it breaks right there something that people don't even know. It's a combination of early music instruments like baroque violins, harps, then baroque guitar, and then also some traditional instruments, percussion like jawbone, like the donkeys, like jawbone, and they're playing it, and drums and things. In this case, we're going to use music from the Puebla Cathedral, from Mexico City, and Oaxaca.
The ensemble directors say their Cher concertgoers will leave familiar with a tune or two, as well as a better understanding of why this fusion of sounds is necessary.
Doing a concert of music that maybe sounds like it might be unfamiliar was a bit of a gamble. But there are two things about that. One is it's not as unfamiliar as people might think. We're surrounded by the sounds of Mexican culture in this country in general, but certainly in Chicago. And so this music will just tick a lot of boxes for people, a lot of memory boxes. I hope they learn what a rich high art culture existed and still exists in Mexico and South America. I think we hear a lot of popular music. We don't hear a lot of the more classical music. And it's incredibly complex and very, very beautiful and very meaningful.
For Chicago Tonight, I'm Angelito.
And you can see a Mexican Christmas concert December 9th through the 11th at various locations throughout the city. You can visit our website for more information. And we're back to wrap things up right after this.
How do we find resources we had no idea about?
The community seems to want us to be in this space.
There's plenty of potential to do that stuff and keep it within the neighborhood and keep it ours.
Chicago Tonight is made possible in part by Alexandra and John Nichols, the Jim and Kay Mabee family, the Polk Brothers Foundation, and the support of these donors.
And that's our show for this Monday night. Don't forget to stay connected with us by signing up for our daily briefing. And you can get Chicago Tonight streamed on Facebook, YouTube, and our website, WTTW.com/news.
You can also get the show via podcast in the PBS Video app. And please join us tomorrow night live at 7. How the CTA is trying to tackle a huge staffing shortfall and make service more reliable.
Plus, meet Chicago's Grammy Award-winning percussion ensemble, Third Coast Percussion, now up for another Grammy. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman.
And I'm Paris Schutz. Thank you so much for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and we'll see you tomorrow.
Closed captioning is made possible in part by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, wishing all a happy and healthy holiday season.